Somehow I had decided not to spend too much time to introduce speakers. You may have noticed this in, also because you can find the information on the website of the college if you'd like to get more informations on the speakers. But for Christine, let me say just two words. Mostly because I know Christine for more than 35 years, actually. I met her and Bernard in Strasbourg. They were working on the floor behind where I was working. And when I started to organize this meeting, I discussed that with Alfonso, because he was also supposed to join, but he could not. We rapidly decided that we should invite Christine and Bernard to come to Paris. And very unfortunately, Bernard became sick and too rapidly passed away. I mentioned this because I would have been extremely pleased to see him joining the crowd, but also to explain why I'm giving my special thanks to Christine to be here today and to tell us about this great work, that the last piece of work that they did together. So Christine, thank you very much, and you have the floor.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. So first of all, I'd like to thank you, Denis, for this kind invitation to be part of this one-day symposium devoted to the making of embryonic model in vitro. So as you say, the managing of the project I will present today was shared with Bernard, my husband, that passed away last year. And before going into the details of the result, I'd like to tell you a bit about who was Bernard as a scientist. So Bernard got his PhD in Strasbourg in LGME, directed by Pierre Chambon, and he was trained as a molecular and developmental biologist, and he's the father of the Twist Drosophila gene that he cloned, and he was in the 80s, so it was a long walk, 18 months, and he sequenced that gene by hand. And he discovers that Twist is absolutely crucial for mesoderm formation at gastrulation of the fly. So I joined his lab at a master degree level, and he trained me, and since then we always worked together. And at that time we worked on the fly in between the interaction of the zygotic gene, Twist, and the morphogen dorsal molecule, which was maternal. So then Bernard got his SANRS position right away after he defends his thesis, which was kind of rare to get such a position so early in the career. After that, we moved together with the family to do a postdoc in University of Oregon in Eugene. And we were among the first generation of postdocs that decided to embark in a new adventure using a new model system, the zebrafish. And still, we were interested in cell determination and axis formation, but now in a vertebrate using zebrafish. Then, after doing this, we went back to IGBMC, the new building that Pierre Chambon decided to create. And we set up our labs, and we focus on dorsoventral and anteroposterior paterni. And then we moved back to the US again, University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And as we were done with dorsoventral and anteroposterior patterning, we moved to left-right asymmetry because there are lots of questions that were not answered yet. And also we developed concept and technology to try to reproduce embryonic development in vitro. And in fact, we used two model systems, zebrafish blastula cells and mouse embryonic stem cells. So on that slide, I'd like to summarize a bit who was Bernard. I think he was really curious about everything. It was his search for knowledge and discovery, and he was super hard worker. He was long in bed and was still working. And he was very sharp. And in fact, he didn't belong to any school of thoughts, and we come up with his own creative hypothesis. Sometimes I was thinking, you're totally crazy, but I would say 98% of the time he was right. And he was the kind of guy that if he has an idea, he wants to test it, and he tests it by himself. So we'll develop the tools and technology to test his hypothesis. And he always looked for perfection for himself, for the student and postdoc, so some students were not that happy with that. And so I think the way of expressing himself was through imaging. I think it was also related to interest he had in general with art. And his motto in life and at work was one step at a time, keep going, push yourself harder, and you will do it. And it was the same attitude when he had a break and will climb high-altitude mountain. He was a serious biker and hiker, so he will push himself really hard, and you just follow him behind. And I think he did the same when he had to fight against cancer, and he fought really hard until the last day. So to summarize, I think what I would like to say is Bernard worked always very hard in silence, didn't look for honors, but this success and the international recognition of his contribution to knowledge, discovery, and novel concepts are his noises. So now I'd like to introduce you how we got involved in the stem cell field, and I will guide you through the concepts we developed. So at the time we got started, some effort had been made already to try to reproduce mammalian development in vitro, and some models were in place, and we talk about that today a lot. So these in vitro mouse models were blastoid and gastroloid, and just to remind you, those models are based on self-organization of stem cell aggregates in response to different conditions, culture condition, the matrix used to grow the aggregate, and also the use of embryonic and extra-embryonic stem cells. So the results that were published at that time is that a variety of tissue were made in vitro, but not the full spectrum of embryonic structure were made like in a wild-type embryo. The frequency of wild-type patterning was not that high, and the blastoid and gastroloid did not survive long. So with the goal for us to try to reproduce embryonic development in vitro, we took another approach. So what we wanted to achieve is three things. First, control the instruction of ESC aggregate in a reliable manner. Second, avoid self-organization as the starting point. And then, recapitulate the successive developmental step of the formation of a mouse embryo in vitro. So how we can do that? So we try to identify from the zebrafish model system potential conserved mechanism between species and define minimal set of factors required for cell determination, differentiation of the swing germ layer and derivative leading to a pattern embryo, and then apply this principle to mouse ESCs. So this is what I call, you know, the picture, what kind of factor we have very early on in the fish. I call it the early embryonic zebrafish situation, the this picture, because we contribute a lot to that busy slide, boring slide, with lots of factors around. But the good news, in fact, you need to take care of only two family of factors that are top of the hierarchy, that are involved in cell determination and also axis determination. That's the BMPs here, and that's a nodule. So BMPs are morphogen, as you probably know, and they act as heterodimer, and they are controlled by a set of inhibitors in yellow here, like cordin, Nogin-1, follistatin like 1B, and FGF3 and FGF8. And nodules in the fish are controlled by competitive inhibitor, LFT1 and LFT2. And on top of this regulation, you have also the wind signaling pathway, which is very important. But what is very good for us as a scientist, we don't have to play with a number of factors which you cannot work with. Two family of factors is enough. And I will tell you how we discover that and how we found out about the function of these molecules. So here you have a zebrafish embryo with the yolk and the embryonic part. And here topologically, you have the animal pole. And what we found is the animal pole contains naive cell that we define to be the ground state, and we use our test tube. So what do I mean by that? In fact, in absence of stimulation by signaling pathway, we form this kind of very ugly embryo. So we just have yolk, and here we just have four brain and one eye. And additionally to that, which was very important to us, those animal pole cells, when they are injected before cell determination with RNA coding for morphogen, so you can commit this animal pole cell in other things that for brain and eye, other cell type, and I will go to that in a minute. So, but first you need to know where BMP and nodule are expressed. So using this wheel embryo from the top, from the animal pole, which is here, and here you have this cartoon representing, so the animal pole, the embryo is here, this is the yolk, so you have the animal pole, ventral side, dorsal side, and here what we call the margin. So BMP are expressed here, mainly on the ventral side, and the gradient goes away like this and decrease, and there is nothing on the dorsal side. For nodal is different, it's all around here at the margin, kind of flat, and then go up here on the dorsal side. So what we have done, we have injected BMP and nodal RNA here at the animal pole, which is our test tube, with different ratio in between BMP and nodal RNA, and we look at the result right now. So again, injecting RNA, BMP and nodal RNA, in one blastomer at the animal pole, together with GFP to follow the clone. And when you have 25 more BMP RNA than nodal, is what you get. So you have the yolk, so you have the endogenous embryo, and this is the clone deriving from what you have injected in one blastomer. So you're making a very good tail containing the three germ layer, and you have four plates, you have somite and everything. And you see it's really deriving because you see some cells expressing GFP. So now, when you inject a mix of BMP and nodal RNA, five more times BMP than nodal, in that case, you don't make a tail. You just make this small stretch, which is posterior trunk identity. And of course, you cannot see that here, but we check with marker, and it's really posterior trunk. Now, if you change the ratio again, 1:1, in that case, you make anterior trunk. So if you look with marker, you will see otic vesicle identity. And last, if you just don't have any BMP, but just nodal, in that case, what you make from this injection, you're making axis in the head. And this is what you see here labeled with sonic hedgehog. So we conclude from these experiments that BMP and nodal have organizing activity, and in fact, what's matter in the ratio in between them. So doing this, injecting BMP and nodal RNA in one blastomer at the animal pole, you get this kind of curve. So you're making sashimis. But if you want to have a full embryo, then you need to recapitulate the gradients the way they are distributed in the wild-type embryo. So how we could do that? In fact, what we've done, we injected BMP RNA and nodal RNA apart, and the best condition was to have two or three blastomers in between. And in that case, you will see it's pretty good because you're getting a primary and a secondary axis are identical. So you cannot say here it's a primary secondary because it's not labeled, but you see you have the same structure, four plate, notochord, somite, and if it's labeled with sonic hedgehog, you see that you make a completory secondary axis extending from the midbrain to the tip of the tail. So of course here you have the cells from the animal pole that are claimed by both the primary and secondary axis, so you have fusion in the head. But sometimes you don't have that fusion, and this is what you get. So you have the yolk, you have the endogenous embryo, and that's the one we're producing from injection at the animal pole. So you see there is some nervous system because you have muscle contraction. You see also that the tails don't move at the same pace. So we assume that the embryo are independent. You see a heart for this one and a heart for this one, and they are connected here. So of course you can argue, you don't know, maybe some cells from the endogenous axis participate to what you do. And we know it was not the case. We had lots of evidence. But I think the best evidence to do the experiments again in vitro. So what do I mean by that? So here we injected again BMP and nodal RNA apart, and then we cut the small piece of animal pole and we put it in culture. So first you form a cavity, and then you form a protrusion with the formation of a blastopore, which is thicker on the dorsal side. And if you look here on that movie, if it works, which I'm not sure, I don't think it works. Anyway, so what you see, what we have seen in vitro is that those explant gastrulate, and the cell gets in and the explant elongates. Let me try one more time to see if I can make it working. No, okay, so just have to trust me. So we look with lots of marker, different stages, and I will just focus on the marker we use at 24 hours, a few examples. So you see we're making a nice set of somites that are segmented. You see a nice neural tube all along here. We are able to make two eyes separated with retina. This marker labels also some neurons, and this is a triple in situ, where we label with a foreign marker, 63B, and we have evidence with this red labeling two bands for homomer 3 and 5, and we label also for MyOD. So we have somite, but they are disorganized, they are not that well done that in this embryo. It was bad luck to get this embryoid with kind of a truncation. But anyway, if you look on the morphology, so you see pretty much the neural plate, you see the notochord, you see the somites are segmented, and at 48 hours, you see you have two eyes, you have otic vesicles. So we were quite happy with that because we get a pretty good anteroposterior and also ventral axis. However, what we were not happy about is just the size of the embryoid, which is kind of small. I would say one third of a Y-type embryo. I think it makes sense because we're cutting really the top of the animal pole region because we didn't want to interfere with the margin where you have everybody there expressed, BMP, nodule, wind, FGF, and so on. So it was a kind of a safety net to make sure we cut really small. So we thought, do two explants, so cut two animal pole, put them in culture, and they stick like crazy, so it's glue. So it was nice, and then you inject again BMP and nodal RNA, and let's say embryoid grow. And now you see that you have a much better and longer and well-developed embryoid, which I would say two-thirds of a Y-type embryo. And in that case, you're making, for example, a very nice head with four brain, olfactory vesicle, eyes, retina, and lenses. So what did we learn from the fish? We learned that we can control determination of a group of pluripotent cells. We learned that BMP and nodal are sufficient to initiate the developmental programs required for the formation of an embryonic axis in vitro. And we are producing breaking of symmetry events with injection of BMP and nodal RNA, which leads to make anteroposterior and also ventral paterni. So now, to go back to the goal of building an in vitro mouse model, we assume that essential mechanisms controlling development are conserved across evolution, and we predicted that instruction of pluripotent ESCs using spatially localized morphogen signals should induce embryonic development. So then we had to come up with an instruction method to deliver the morphogen to ESCs aggregate, and this was not easy. But at the end, what works the best, in fact, is merging of two aggregates. So this is a protocol. So at D0, by the hanging drops method, we're making two kind of aggregates. Small aggregates, 50 cells, and large aggregates, 100 cells. And we let those cells, those aggregates grow, but we leave them in a very basic medium just to allow the cell to exit pluripotency. And then we take the small aggregates of 50 cells and we incubate them with BMP4 mouse protein during 8 hours. And then at D3, we do the merging in between the small instructed aggregate and the large naive aggregate, and we let the embryoid grow. So right now I need to tell you that compared to the fish, where you saw we injected BMP and nodal RNA. In that case, we just need BMP4 protein because BMP4 mouse protein induced nodal and WNT3, and I will show you the result next slide. And also we use a very poor medium because we didn't want to interfere with the instruction method. So you have the data, so you have the cartoon showing you a large naive aggregate which is not instructed and that express GFP, and the small aggregate, which is instructed with the mouse BMP4 protein. So you see the fusing, and then you see the embryoid elongating. So now, as I told you a previous slide, this asymmetric instruction by the mouse BMP4 protein leads to induction of expression of nodal, WIN3, and a readout, brachyury, which is a mesodermal marker. And here you see it in a strain, which is brachyury GFP. So you see brachyury expression in green. So we conclude from these experiments that we are able to generate an artificial signaling center acting as an organizer. Of course, next we had to go through a checklist to know what we were making in those embryoids, and also if we can conclude or not that we were making or not a true model for mammalian development in vitro. So the first things we check was gastrulation, and yes, I think we can say it occurs. So you have a first set of experiments where we did fusion in between naive and able aggregate with instructed aggregate that contain two types of cells, brachyury GFP cell in gray and in white non-instructed cells. So what you're seeing here in the medium panel, it's the mesodermal cells, because it's brachyury GFP, it's a brachyury is a marker for mesoderm, that are induced by WNT and nodal here in that ball. So what you see here, that the cell move anteriorly. So that's my red arrow. So now we have seen that nodal and WNT promote mesoderm identity in cell of the instruction aggregate, but they induce also mesoderm in a non-treated aggregate. So this is what we see here. So we did the reverse. So we did a fusion in between a naive aggregate. We contain non-labeled cells in white and brachyury GFP cells in gray. We fuse with an instructed aggregate with non-labeled cells. So again, here, what you're seeing, it's a cell induced by WNT and nodal, but here now, in that big aggregate. So those cells move first posteriorly, and then they move back anteriorly. So we're thinking that the migratory behavior of mesodermal cell in embryoid is reminiscent to that of the mouse embryo at the onset of gastrulation. Then we wanted to know, do we have three germ layers? So we start with endoderm, and yes, we see the formation and differentiation of the endoderm in different steps. And so, for example, what we see first is a cell sorting with GATA6 cells in red and NANOG cells in green. And this leads to primitive endoderm epithelium formation. And then we see with a set of different markers an endoderm-like epithelium, which is a mosaic of visceral and definitive endoderm. And then we see the presence of region of a primitive tube, and we see also some folding. And I will show, just summarize on with a few markers. This one, for example, Claudin 4, will label all endoderm epithelium. This one, Epile, will label ventral foregut and eye gut. And here, so we check with marker, of course, and morphologically, you can see anteroposterior and dorsoventral patterning in the primitive gut of the embryoid, for example, foregut, midgut, hindgut, and on the ventral side, you see yolk stalk and yolk sac rudiment, and you see pockets. So now, what about the mesodermal germ layer and its derivative? So it was very important for us to see if we can get an autocord, because that's a landmark of a chordate, so you really need to get an autocord. Do we get one? Yes, we do. So you have the embryoid on the right and on the left, and you have the corresponding cartoon for the mouse on the right. So we check with different markers because we really wanted to make sure. So for example, cordin that would label all notochord, FOXG1 that would label notochord and node, and this marker, noto, that will mark posterior notochord. Next question, is the notochord placed normally along anteroposterior and dorsoventral axis? The answer is yes. So here, for anteroposterior patterning, so we use in blue OTX2, which label forebrain and midbrain in the mouse, and you see that brachyury in red here, labeling the axis and the tailbone. So this is correct. And now for the dorsoventral patterning, we label with SOX2 here, which is in the oral plate in blue, and you see just ventral to the neural plate, you see expression of brachiae. So do we have paraxial mesoderm? Yes, we have paraxial mesoderm, which are separated. So you have the midline, so you have the paraxial mesoderm in two bands. So this paraxial mesoderm is segmented in a fraction of embryoid, not all of them. So here, this is a cartoon representing the situation in the mouse, and here I magnification of a region of an embryoid. So what you're seeing here, it's expression of Cerberus 1, which is in red, so like two bands, in the anterior part of somite 1 and the anterior part of the non-segmented mesoderm. And just posterior to that, you see this labeling of MESP1, just adjacent. So that's the correct location. The location of these two markers on embryoid is identical to the mouse. Then we check for intermediate mesoderm. We have some. We check for heart, so we can see with marker heart progenitor. We see heart, and we see heart beating. It's not very difficult to get that. And we see also with this isoform of hemoglobin, a presence of primitive erythrocytes, which are densely packed at the outer surface of the embryoid, next to the yolk sac. We have evidence for vasculogenesis. So in the mouse and in the embryoid, you see a big bulb here, which corresponds to the territory where the heart is. And we see two roads here, probably dorsal aorta or maybe a vitelline vein, and here scattered cells of the aorta. So this was labeled with KIDR at D0.5.5. But if you look at D8, you see now that this have invaded a lot the embryoid. And so this marker shows you that you have a big reticular network. And we see also a capillary. And we see also a new capillary forming for existing capillary, probably through sprout outgrowths and fusion. So the mesodermal layer was kind of good, I think. So because we see a presence of notochord, as I say, we wanted really to have that, a landmark of a vertebrate, is important structure. We see the presence of all mesodermal population, and the topology is in agreement with their counterpart in mass relative to AP, DV, and mediolateral axis. What about the ectodermal layer? Not difficult to see, you don't see anything here, but I can see it. Neural plate here on the dorsal side of the embryo. Or you can see it when you use a strain, SOX1 GFP. So you see the neural plate is labeled here in green. So we have evidence for anteroposterior patterning. For example, we use N-grade 2, which is located at the anterior part, so anterior midbrain and hindbrain. We look for expression of paxis that normally in the mouse are labeled from the hindbrain, the spinal cord, and down to the tailbone. So we have this territory. But you see here, I put a green arrow. You see that paxis in the mouse label also the forebrain territory. And you see there is nothing there. So the embryoid do not form any forebrain. We have evidence for segmentation in the hindbrain. And we check also all the collection of OX gene, and I just show you one example, where we see OX D4 expressed from the posterior midbrain, spinal cord, down to the tip of the tail. We have evidence for formation of neural crest and neural plate borders. And so I think it's not bad for the anteroposterior patterning. Now, what about the dorsal anterior patterning is correct, and dorsal ventral patterning for that? We use a marker, OLIC2, which is a marker for motor neuron progenitor. And we can see it on the ventral part of the neural tube. And OLIC2, in fact, is induced by sonic hedgehog, a morphogen that is secreted by notochord and foreplate. And if you do a double labeling with OLIC2 in blue here, so again, in the ventral part of the neural plate, you see that sonic hedgehog is ventral to this expression. So sonic hedgehog is in red. So that's the correct location. So then we wanted to know if we can see some histological characteristic of the neural plate in the embryoid could be identical to a wild-type mouse embryo. And I think this is the case. So we found a pseudo-stratified monolayer epithelium. So we did some mosaic where we use 90% unlabeled cells and 10% ESCs expressing constitutive GFP. And we see these long individual neuroectodermal cells that extend from apical to basal side of the epithelium. We can see some apical basal polarity with accumulation of actin and accumulation of lamellin in the basal side. And we have mitosis also at the apical surface. We found some marker expressing neurons like TUP3 and double cortin expressing neurons that extend their axon within the neural plate and towards the non-neural part. And these TUP3 expressing neurons are seen in multiple layers of the anterior neural plate. And we see also at D8, a folding of the neural plate, we can identify dorsolateral hinge point, and at D8.5, we see closure into a neural tube. So I think I can say that the embryoid display a neural plate, neural tube-like structure with anteroposterior and dorsoventral axis, and histological characteristic of a typical mammalian neural plate, neural tube. So, of course, we did some transcriptionic of embryoid at D8 versus mouse embryo. We performed bulk, single-cell RNA-seq, pseudo-times differentiation trajectory. And what we found is that the transcription of embryoid at D8, the best correlation with mouse at 8.5. And I will summarize the result we got. So we found 24 clusters in the mouse, 23 in the embryoid. We do not have any surface ectoderm. The larger cluster in the embryoid are organized in a continuum of states with the same spatial temporal features than in the mouse. We found some differences. We have a bigger neuron cluster in the embryoid versus the mouse. And we have also a small number of cells for allantois and erythrocytes. But I think that's the way we prepare the sample, because the erythrocyte at the surface of the embryoid. So when we prepare the sample, the erythrocyte goes away. But we have the same marker than in the mouse. And also, the cells are ordered from the progenitor to the most differentiated cell, and this correlates with the position of cell along the epi or dorsoventral axis. So altogether, I would say that compared to the in situ, we pretty much see the same thing. That is that the segregation in the embryoid of stale state along the AP and DV axes are similar to the mouse embryo, except we don't make the forebrain and part of the midbrain. So that's the main weak point. We don't make any forebrain. And we know that for making anteroposterior patterning, we rely on interplay of WNT3 and nodal and their antagonists. And their antagonists are DKK1, SFRP1 and Cerberus1 for WNT3, and LFT1 for nodal that are secreted by AVA. It has been reported that WNT3 and DKK1 control head morphogenesis. But now, when you look at embryoid at D5 and you look where WNT3 RNA is expressed, it's really, really extended. It should not be like this in the mouse, it's much smaller. So we're thinking that the Wnt gradient is too strong, extend too anteriorly, and this is why we prevent forebrain formation. So we embark in a series of studies using different methods to try to correct that deficiency. So for example, fusion of an additional aggregate, so we take the same protocol, but we had another aggregate that will be releasing Wnt and or nodal inhibitor. And the second method is to do a tet-on, tet-off, which will allow us to control when we apply the inhibitors. And we have encouraging results, so probably this is the way. So I like to summarize what I've told you so far. So we didn't choose to take a combination of ingredients and play with the cell organization of stem cells. Instead, we use the knowledge we got from the fish, identifying the top hierarchy factor for cell determination and axis determination, because we really wanted to control development from the start using this morphogen. And we use BMP4 in the mouse. This is enough because it induces nodal and WNT3. And what was important also is to have an asymmetric instruction, because like this you can make some breaking symmetry events. And this is it. Your phi is set up.
And then
you go up to mid-gestation, and I think I can tell you that we provide a model, which we call embryoid, for studying neural stage mouse embryo. So I think it's already a powerful model for in vitro study because we're making a notochord, we have endoderm, we have vascularization, we have neural crest, we have a good neural tube. This is not perfect. And I won't say this is the mouse embryo until that stage, blah, blah, blah. No. But it's already good, and I think what is powerful about that method, you can change a lot of things in there. The timing of instruction, the size of the signaling center, the intensity of stimulation, and also you can do mosaic. So it opens us lots of things. For example, try to understand better and manipulating gradients, or modeling disease. So we use CRISPR-Cas9 on this aggregate, and it works really well. We can phonocopy some mutation in the mouse, or do some drug design and drug screening, and also develop a human counterpart. So I think I'm pretty much done. And I like to thank Bernard, who was on top of everything. I always like this. And also the people that developed the concept in the fish, Antoine, Jean-Daniel, Karine, Nathalie, and also courageous people that switch from fish to the world of mouse embryonic stem cell. Not that easy for them, Pengfei and Magar, and then the people that took over, Jingwu, Ricardo and Jonathan, and the agencies that provide us with some money to do this project on stem cell. And I thank you for your attention.